North Idaho News of the Week is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty, commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com. Morning. It is Friday, June 13th, 2025, and you're listening to North Idaho News of the Week on 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio. I'm Jack Peterson, without Chris Bessler this morning, joined, however, by the editor-in-chief of the Sandpoint Reader, Zach Hagedon. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning, Jack.
It's nice to see you on another lovely June morning here. You know, no thunderstorms yesterday that I saw. Looked like it was threatening, but...
My trick knee was acting up, but, you know, it was a false alarm.
Okay. I'll start with some headlines. I'm going to do what is probably, for the last time this spring, will I be announcing the lake level. It is currently 2,062.24 feet above sea level is the surface of Lake Ponderay. That is just a few inches shy of what is considered full pool at 2,062.5 feet. So as of next week, we expect the lake to reach full summer pool and remain there. So unless you hear otherwise, you can just assume that that's the level of the lake from now on. Looking at the state news, zooming out a little bit here, with only a few weeks remaining in the current fiscal year, the new one begins July 1st, state revenues are now $141 million below the Idaho legislature's projections. The projected year-end budget balance has shrunk from $420 million to $278 million, according to a report from the Legislative Services Office. Also, news from Boise, but from the National Interagency Fire Center. Forecast was issued for the year showing higher potential than average for significant wildfire in northern Idaho starting this month in June. And that risk of significant wildfire spreads south throughout the state and throughout the inland northwest as the season wears on into July and August. So it could be a smoky summer as this dry heat wave that we're in continues. Here's one from the reader. The Idaho State Police have entered into a partnership with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that's ICE, to transport immigrants who are convicted of a crime and are not authorized to be in the United States to ICE detention centers for deportation. In other regional news, the International Selkirk Loop, the board of directors has called for a swift resolution to the U.S.-Canada trade war in an open letter published on June 6th, which was kind of interesting that ordinarily apolitical tourism-focused organization making a kind of a direct statement on national policy was an item of interest in this week's reader. Around the lake, Green Bay Campground is open for day use, but remains closed for overnight camping until a campground host is put in place by the National Forest Service. Down in Sagal, a petition has been launched on change.org demanding the return of firefighters to the Kerrywood Station, which is currently unstaffed following the failure of fire levies in the May 2025 election. The staff was, or the former staff of the Carrywood Fire Station was redeployed elsewhere, and in an attempt to save funds, and those funds will be redirected towards maintaining the aging fleet. Sandpoint Police Captain Rick Bailey has announced his retirement and will be retiring on June 16th. Also in Sandpoint, but just north of town, out on North Boyer, a culvert failed, and travel on North Boyer Road, just past the fairgrounds, but including, I believe, including Schweitzer Cutoff Road, the road is cut off, severed, because a culvert collapsed, and that road closure will persist until for at least a couple weeks, according to the Bonner County Daily Bee. Over in Ponderay, the Aquatic Center, the Ponderay Aquatic Center has been proposed, and there will be an official launch party, and questions will be answered at an event on June 18th, coming up next week. A possible aquatic center being proposed for the Field of Dreams over in Ponderay. And we're looking ahead at a busy weekend. It is the Chafe 150, June 14th. It's also Father's Day weekend, and that's on Sunday. And then on June 14th, a rally, the nationwide No King's Day rally, will be held in Sandpoint in front of the Bonner County Courthouse. That's the one on First Avenue from noon to 2 o'clock p.m. And I would say that anticipated turnout for that is probably pretty high, considering kind of what's been going on in the national news lately. I think we're going to see a good turnout at that protest, my guess.
I think that's a good prognostication,
forecast,
yes.
Forecast as well, Zach?
Right, I would say so.
Yeah. I don't remember what the biggest one yet has been so far this year, but it's been in the hundreds, right?
I think there were estimates about 800,
yeah,
or so,
right,
at the last big rally.
The last time there was a big one like that. Yeah. Well, that's coming up this weekend. Could be interesting, especially. I mean, this is just traffic management, I guess. But the Chafe 150 going right past on City Beach while the on the way down to City Beach as the protest is going on is going to make for some interesting, interesting traffic management, I would say, for the city of Sandpoint.
The whole day is going to be interesting, I would imagine.
Yeah. Let's see. So that was a long list of headlines. There's just a lot of kind of little things going on without any one big story, I would say, dominating the newspaper this week. The Sandpoint Reader, which I hold in my hand.
We had Art Walk on the cover.
So hey, yeah,
that dominated.
That's true. We were just talking to them yesterday. I think POAC stopped by and talked to us on the morning show about Art Walk. Yeah, now it's a big. As we said, it's a big weekend.
Right,
a lot going on. How about this? The International Selkirk Loop. I don't think I've ever read a any kind of like open letter from the International Selkirk Loop. Ever. It's interesting to see them kind of wading into the fray here on the hot button issue of U.S.-Canada relations. I don't know.
Well,
how did it come to you? They said they wrote this, they wrote a letter and sent it to the local media, and it came across your desk, I think, late last week, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a press release sort of announcing a letter that they had sent to the congressional delegation,
mm-hmm.
And to the members of parliament for the affected sort of Canadian members, mm-hmm. of the organization. And, the cities that we have within the loop, it's like Sandpoint, Bonner's Ferry, Medellin Falls, Newport in Washington, mm-hmm. Creston, Nelson, and Selmo in British Columbia. So it's like a 280-mile scenic driving loop. That you can go through all these different communities.
And right, I guess, yeah, if people aren't aware.
They may have seen the signs. Uh-huh. There's some signs along on that route.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of operate as kind of a maybe a loose sort of tourism board together, mm-hmm. sort of coordinate maybe some marketing things, you know, directing tourists to each other's communities.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, that has not, in my memory anyway, been sort of a political organization, but mm-hmm. it underscores just how sort of chaotic the tariff situation has been over the past couple of months, you know, with the President Donald Trump announcing these, you know, sweeping tariffs all around the world, including, you know, the 25% tariff on Canadian goods, and also, you know, rhetoric about making Canada the 51st state.
Mm-hmm.
So if we remember back to, you know, February, March, April, especially I think in April, the tensions got really high with mm-hmm. outgoing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau getting on Canadian sort of national TV and making a really fiery speech. It was unlike anything I've ever seen. And I don't know if anyone in living memory has ever seen the Canadians get that riled up against the United States, urging Canadians to only buy Canadian goods, you know, threatening reciprocal tariffs. And I think that message really resonated across Canada and including, you know, in places like British Columbia and in our own border communities, where a couple months back, publisher Ben Olson and I did a sort of a joint piece where we talked to a couple of Canadian citizens who live just across the border, sort of Creston area, just to kind of get their feelings. And they were outraged. One of them vowed never to return to the United States. Mm-hmm. Another group sent a letter to Sandpoint Mayor Jeremy Grimm, actually, which is how we heard about it, was through a public records request, I guess, where we got that letter, where they just sort of outlined all the reasons why they would not be returning to Sandpoint. They're not going to come to Schweitzer. They've been coming to Schweitzer for decades, them and all their friends and family. They spent tons of money. They rented, you know, hotel rooms. They went out to eat every single night. So they just wanted to sort of let the mayor know that this is having an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at kind of the broader cross-border numbers, I think CTV News in April, that's a Canadian TV network, reported that, you know, border crossings from Canada into the U.S. fell 900,000 from March of 2024. So, you know, year over year, it was almost a million fewer visitors. And then, you know, crossings by passenger vehicles and pedestrians fell about 26%, which was the lowest since, like, the COVID pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And then in our local area here, like Eastport and Port Hill, the border stations up in Boundary County, the last time we looked at numbers, and I couldn't find any newer ones, so I guess these kind of still stand, but traditionally, we'd had about 23,000 to 24,000 monthly crossings from Canada between November of 2024 and January of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And that average of 23 to 24 per month fell to 19,100 in February, which is just about right after, you know, the big tariff announcements.
Yeah.
And we figured, you know, that's a decrease of about 12.4% over the year. And just from January to February, it fell 17%.
Yeah.
So these are significant reductions in cross-border traffic, and in places like Bonner's Ferry especially, and, you know, some of these smaller towns that are right on the border, that traffic is significant economic is a significant economic driver.
Mm-hmm.
People coming across, you know, just for the day, they might stop and eat something to, you know, get something to eat, they might stop at a grocery store, they might go to a souvenir shop, whatever. And I think when we first saw reporting on this issue back in April-ish, there were some interviews with folks up in Bonner's, and there were businesses that said flat out, like, look, that margin, if we lose that margin, that's like my profit margin.
Yeah.
I will be out of business.
Yeah.
I mean, it might not seem like a lot to some people, but for a lot of businesses, that's like the difference between opening and closing their doors.
Mm-hmm.
And as a region, you know, it's hard to track down precise economic impact numbers for this kind of stuff. But it is very clear that if we lose 12.4%, 17% of our cross-border visitors, that's going to have an impact.
Yeah.
And just in the lodging alone, you know, the city of Sandpoint has like a 14% lodging tax. If we don't have Canadians booking hotel rooms here, you know, we're not going to get that part of the tax.
Yeah.
Likewise with Ponderé, they have a lodging tax now. And a lot of these towns have lodging taxes. So just that alone is probably going to be felt in just for like tax dollars.
Yeah.
The organization here, the Selkirk Loop, I mean, they sort of pointed all these factors out and said, you know, whatever, just get over yourselves, have a swift resolution to this. And, you know, these trade disputes and travel restrictions threaten not only our businesses, but also the generations of good neighborly trust and collaboration that have existed here for centuries. And that was a quote from the board chair, Carla Aaron. And so, and I thought that was interesting too, because it hits on sort of the intangible element too, which is the sort of the diplomatic side of it, the friendliness, the cross-border amity that we've had for, for, you know, centuries. Since the War of 1812, perhaps.
I was going to say, yeah, it would be hard to think of a time, I struggled to think of a time when it's been as tense between the United States and Canada in the 20th century anyway. Yeah, I think you go back at least to the 19th to, to find that that kind of hostility, not that it's been, you know, turned into any kind of, you know, actual violence or anything like that, but it's, yeah, the relationship has cooled significantly.
Yeah, I mean the the emotional relationship and the financial relationship.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's turn the page to a new petition for the return of staffing at the Kerrywood Fire Station. A lot of fire news, I guess, in the news this week, and no actual blazes currently out there in the woods, but yes, a lot of administrative fire type stuff going on as everybody ramps up for what is predicted to be possibly a big fire year. The background here, in May, voters rejected levies, some proposed permanent fire district levies that would have raised taxes, and those funds would have gone to pay for, among other things, the Selkirk Fire District. When the levies failed, the one of the more immediate responses was that on May 21st, Jeff Armstrong, the chief of the Selkirk Fire, as well as Northside, Sagal, and Westside Fire Districts, announced that paid staff in Kerrywood would be taken off the job around the beginning of June, and that would enable the fire service to save, quote, a substantial amount in overtime and personnel costs. Those funds shifted immediately to the maintenance of our aging fleet, fire station repairs, and equipment replacement. That was end of May. Now here we are mid-June, actually dated June 6th, so beginning at the last week, some Sagal residents have begun circulating this petition online on change.org. The demands, the supporters call on the Selkirk Fire District commissioners to, one, reinstate local fire coverage at the Kerrywood Station, two, involve the community in future planning and funding efforts, and three, prioritize rural response coverage in all operational decisions. Just to finish finish your article here, the last line comes from that petition. These firefighters were more than a service. They were our neighbors, our lifeline, and our peace of mind. Kerrywood deserves better. Are these demands reasonable in your view, Zach Hagedon? Do you think this is something that Selkirk Fire are these demands that Selkirk Fire is capable of meeting with their, you know, current in their current state, fiscal state?
Well, I would hesitate to speak for Chief Armstrong, but
yeah,
I imagine that if he could do these things, he would. I mean, I don't think he would have wanted to take that staffing out of the Kerrywood Station. I mean,
yeah,
it was very clear through the whole run-up to that May election how critical it was to get those levies passed to maintain current staffing and to increase staffing and to maintain, you know, the fleet and to do maintenance and repair on the facilities, buy equipment, maintain equipment. I mean, I think Chief Armstrong did a pretty bang-up job of spreading the message to promote the levies. But, you know, obviously there were other messages out there, you know, saying that this was an unnecessary tax increase, you know, that people were already being overtaxed in other areas of their lives. Kind of the typical anti-tax argument. And that clearly resonated with people. And they voted down every levy. You know, the Northside, Sagal, and Westside all failed those levies.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, the chief was kind of put in the position where it's like, we got to cut something. And, you know, taking a staff member out of Kerrywood apparently was the decision they made. And I couldn't imagine that he would disagree with this petition.
Yeah.
However, I don't know what they can do. I mean, I think it's a pretty big step to cut staffing at a fire station.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that in the fire service. So bringing that person back is going to mean a cut somewhere else, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
You can only do what you can with the money that you have. I know there's a lot of talk around the election time, especially among people who were opposed to the levies. They really kind of like leaned into this notion of, well, we just need to have more volunteers. We need to get the volunteer fire program going again and just get our community members to step up and do this. Well, this might be an opportunity for the community members to step up. Like maybe the people who voted against this levy might start volunteering to serve in the fire districts and they could staff that station with a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one solution, I suppose. So I don't know. I mean, and you say there's a lot of administrative fire talk lately, but we also did have a fire in Laclede.
That's true.
Fairly recently. So,
yeah, there was a big one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So very fairly soon after the election with the failure of the levies, the fire districts had to spring into action and fight that fire in Laclede, which could have gotten really bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Idaho Department of Lands came in and helped out, and it was they successfully got it out. There was no injuries, but it was structure fire and, some land burned up.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of was a pretty stark reminder that, this stuff happens. And if we don't have the resources, who knows what might happen. And I think this is sort of the reason for this petition is I think that residents are kind of looking around and seeing how dry it is and noticing that we haven't had much rain, if any, in recent weeks. And then they're hearing news, like you were mentioning from the Interagency Fire Center, that we're facing a higher than average risk.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the insurance issue that got brought up during the election, that if we have continued dry weather and continued extreme, or not extreme, but higher and higher risks of fire, it's going to get harder and harder for people to get fire insurance because insurance companies aren't going to want to take on that risk, especially if there's not adequate fire protection, which is an argument that has been kind of going off and on throughout this whole discussion. And I look at the petition, and it doesn't seem unreasonable. I mean, you asked me if I thought it was reasonable. I think these are pretty basic, basic demands. We want a firefighter. We want staffing at our station. We want to be involved in the planning and funding, and we want our rural areas to be prioritized. And that's, I think, perfectly reasonable considering the fact that we are such a rural county. And that's what the fire districts primarily serve rural areas. So that's kind of in their mission statement.
Yeah.
And then I looked at the petition again just now to see how many people had signed it. And as of this morning, there's 143 have signed. And if you look at the election numbers, the number of people who voted in favor of passing the levy in May was 741.
Huh. Yeah.
So presumably, if all 741 of those people that wanted the levy to pass see this petition, you could expect that they would sign it.
Yeah.
And it will be interesting to see if that happens and if that does happen, if it goes above that number and gets into sort of the 1,253 range, which was the number of people that voted against it. So that if this petition gets out with enough rigor and people see it and sign it, it could end up being sort of a keyhole view into whether or not people have changed their minds about that vote they made in May. Who knows?
The next time a fire district levy can be on the ballot, if I'm not mistaken, it won't be until, May 2027? Is that, I might look that up here, but,
sadly, I don't have the election calendars memorized.
But yeah.
It is going to be a while.
I'm surprised.
It's surprising I don't by now, but
yeah.
But I would be very surprised if we don't see a return of these in some form.
Right. Something.
And depending on what happens with our fire seasons in the interim,
I'm not going to look at the full election calendar right this second, but yeah, it's
not going to be next year. I'll tell you that.
Right. It's not next year. It's not November. It's going to be a while that the fire districts are sort of running lean, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll see. We'll see what happens. See if those, you mentioned volunteers. I think that's that really can only go so far. I mean, I think that if I remember previous conversations with, you know, the fire officials around here, they rely greatly on volunteer firefighters, but you need some paid staff to right. to manage those fires in general.
Yeah. Well, and the volunteer program, and the Chief Armstrong said it himself during one, I think it was the fireplace forum, I think. I think it was there that he said this, that the volunteer fire department had basically disappeared because people just weren't signing up.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was growing up, you know, the 80s and 90s, there were tons of volunteer firefighters. My dad was one. And, you know, he had buddies that were, and it was just kind of something that a lot of people did, I guess, but not anymore. So the chief expressed great interest in revitalizing that program. So,
yeah. Okay. We only have a few minutes left here. It was a quiet week in City of Sandpoint news. Was there anything that didn't quite make the paper, on the city beat, Zach? Anything of note?
Not particularly. The Planning and Zoning Commission last Tuesday had sort of a discussion about what kind of residential housing should be allowed in the commercial A zone. And I'm going to circle back to that as that conversation develops a little more fully.
Yeah.
Because it was just sort of a presentation, kind of just chit chat.
Not an action item.
There was no action items on it, but it's an interesting concept. And I think that as we get a little bit closer with some of the other ordinances that they're working on, I mean, we seem to be sort of in a work session or work period at City Hall right now. The big decisions aren't really on the agenda as far as I can tell, but a lot of like big changes that will result in big decisions, right? So, I mean, they're working on parking ordinances. They're talking about what kind of housing should be downtown. And I think a lot of this stuff's going to come to fruition later in the summer where we're going to see kind of, you know, what this vision is for how we're going to manage a lot of these like really core aspects of the town.
Yeah. Right now, I mean, this conversation kind of exists in the shadow of the, particularly I think that proposal for the Church Street multifamily
right.
development, large, relatively large for Sandpoint anyway, you know, housing development coming to what we would call kind of the downtown core. Yeah, but that passed, that I think a 5-2 went through planning and zoning. So will these conversations have an effect on that development, or is that kind of, that one's just rolling on?
I don't think that they could retroactively apply anything to that.
Right, because it's already been approved, yeah.
But it was made clear to me, anyway, in recent weeks, that it was made clear to city officials that folks were not happy with, you know, some of the existing rules, especially related to, you know, required parking for development in downtown. And the city officials were quite clear that, yeah, we're going to work on an ordinance for this. And we're going to change some things so that, you know, maybe we don't see similar types of controversy surrounding developments.
Yeah.
So I would hesitate to speculate, but I would hazard to guess that this discussion at P&Z about what kind of housing to allow in commercial A is related to that and would potentially have an impact on future developments of that kind.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see, I guess, what happens. And we only have about a minute left. You riding your bike this weekend, Zach? Are you in the Chafe 150?
I'm going to offend a lot of people when I say this and maybe shock some, but I haven't ridden a bike in probably 15 years.
I'm offended.
I'm a pedestrian.
Okay.
Through and through.
Good old
I know people who are riding their bikes this weekend. My stepmom is riding the Chafe, and she's doing another ride on Sunday, so she's going to be on her bike a lot.
Another ride on Sunday around here? Really? I don't even know what
exactly it is. Okay.
Another
one. Unrelated, but
okay. It is the 48th Annual Art Walk. That's on the cover of this week's Sandpoint Reader. It's a very cool cover. It's that owl, and this is fabric. This is not a painting or a drawing. It's made of fabric. Pretty cool. And then the No King's Day rally, we will see, and we will be talking about that, I'm sure, next week. But that's this coming Saturday, and we expect a pretty good turnout. You know, we'll see what happens. I'm guessing the story on that is probably going to be that's a nationwide story. That's not necessarily going to be. I don't know that Sandpoint's going to be.
There's going to be thousands of these, is what I heard, and potentially, yeah. I mean, who knows how many nationwide?
Yeah. Okay, it is time now for Otto's Eclectic Mix here on 88.5 KRFY. Thanks for listening to the North Idaho News of the Week. Thank you, Zach, for coming in.
Thank you, Jake.
It's always nice to visit with you, talk about what's going on in town. And now we're going to play some music. Here we go. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week right here on 88.5 KRFY.